I'm Anne McCants. I'm an economic historian, actually of the Middle Ages, at MIT, and I often feel like I must be one of the stranger people in the room. Except now that I know Brad's been in campus ministry, you're actually probably the strangest person in the room. So that's good. but anyway, I'll say a little bit about my own academic background as well, because it has been quite interdisciplinary, and I have some thoughts about that that will, I think, lead into the questions that Larry and the organizing team posed for us. I actually began college thinking I would major in English, was cured of that in one semester after some very traumatic writing experiences with a woman who was cruel. but anyway, then I was an economics major, and I stuck with that, but I also sort of fell in love with history along the way and was one course shy of a major in religion and one course shy of a major in German literature. I refused to take the 20th century German literature class, and so therefore couldn't major in that. And started graduate school in economics and figured out pretty quickly that what I really wanted to be was an economic historian, and that I wanted to teach Western Civ rather than principles. And so switched to a PhD program in history, and in fact, to Susan's point about money late yesterday afternoon, which I didn't agree with her entirely, but partially, as I was leaving the PhD program in economics, one of the micro-sequence professors called me in and tried to persuade me that I was making a big mistake. You know, there's not that many women in economics. You could be one of them, blah, blah, blah. And sort of, you know, when I wasn't persuaded, he pulled out all the stops and said, you know, you'll make a lot more money with a PhD in economics, and you could still do economic history. And I looked at him sort of steely-eyed, and I said, I don't care about money. And the conversation was over. That said, it turns out I actually do care about money. I didn't have children yet. But anyway, that's a conversation I think we do need to go back to. But I want to say something about interdisciplinary, because, and I also became involved in gender and women's studies. And so I often sit in many different disciplinary contexts. And the thing we always say about interdisciplinary work is, you know, that these are the people who can see the commonalities between things, and I think that that's true, but I think we also have to be clear-eyed about where the differences are. These things are interdisciplinary precisely because these disciplines really are different. And if we get too sort of in love with the, gosh, we see the commonalities everywhere, it is possible to forget that there are differences. And so I want to actually say something about a program that I'm directing now at MIT called the Concourse Freshman Learning Community. And the basic idea is to take a relatively small group of students, about 50 of them a year, and teach them their science core required courses in the context of also an sort of active, vibrant, humanistic, and I've thrown in a little social science, context. And I'm going to say a little bit more about that in a moment. But that has really gotten me thinking about the differences between science and technology, right? Because, of course, you know, as a sort of everyday historian, it was really easy to sort of say science and technology in the same sentence. And, of course, all the emphasis on STEM or STEAM or whatever reinforces that. And science, it seems to me, is actually a process of discovery. That's about finding out about the world, whereas technology is really about changing the world, right? That's really what, you know, engineers do, right? They are grounded in the non-natural world of artifacts. They make things. They develop processes and so forth. And some even say that science is ultimately not motivated by sort of utilitarian purposes, right? It's to know for the sake of knowing, whereas technology, I mean, the things that engineers do are really about solving a problem, meeting a need, creating a new desire, right? Generating a market, possibly making money, maybe making people better, right? I mean, whatever the motivation is, there's still this extrinsic motivation. And I think, though, it's really important for our students to understand that those two things, sort of science and engineering really are different, even though they show up in that acronym all the time, sort of mushed together. And yet, both of them, it seems to me, are critically dependent on, for their diffusion, on communities of believers. And I'm using the term believer sort of really deliberately and maybe slightly provocatively. In science, we call that peer review, right? The sort of the internal community has to believe in, you know, sort of the way you are understanding the world. In technology, we call those people users, right? They're consumers or, you know, whatever. They're the people who use your software, the people who follow your process, et cetera. But neither the scientists nor the engineers can be successful unless they generate this community of believers. And so it seems to me that all the kinds of arguments that we privilege in our university education, rational, scientific, technical, logical, whatever we want to call them, all of those arguments per se do not create either successful scientists or engineers. Because to be a successful scientist or an engineer, you have to embed yourself in this community of believers. You have to be persuasive to them. And I'll try to avoid using the word rhetoric, but really, it's important. And it seems to me that the liberal studies component of an engineering education, this idea that has been put before us, serves two purposes then. One is intellectual. It could help our students to distinguish the realm of truth claims, right, science, broadly writ, from the realm of making useful artifacts. And I don't see that as a hierarchical differential, just a difference. And our students would be really well served by being able to make that intellectual distinction. But secondly, this liberal studies, as we've been talking about it, could provide the social and community context in which both scientists and engineers and, you know, historians and, you know, campus ministers and all kinds of people, right? It's the context in which we have to understand it if we're going to be successful at the things we do. And it's not, Larry and I were talking on the way in this morning, this isn't the sort of, you know, the soft skills, right, of communication. This is everything about understanding what are the useful problems to solve, what are the important problems to solve, you know, what are the trade-offs when we make one group of people better with something, but we at the same time make some other group of people worse off? How do we think about that? How do we communicate the ideas we have? How do we persuade people of the ideas we have? I mean, it's a whole complex of things. So not just, you know, that sort of engineers need to learn to talk to people. It's a lot more than that. So let me say something briefly about the kinds of things I've done kind of on the ground. Something that a colleague and I are going to be launching, we hope, for next spring, that is to say, not next week, but a year away, and then I'll sit down. So the sort of two formative experiences I've had that have gotten me more into the company of engineers, I guess, well, one of them was just being hired at MIT. The other was developing a course with Susan Silby, who's going to be speaking on the next panel this morning at MIT for our own graduate students who are in history, anthropology, and STS, a course on social science research methods. And she was the qualitative person, and I was the quantitative person. But really, we both had a passion for getting our own students to think about research design as an intellectual activity and not just something that kind of happens by accident because you're really in love with a topic. And the people who ended up taking our course overwhelmingly were not our own students, amazingly enough, because they didn't think they needed us, but a lot of engineering systems design students. And so we ended up teaching a lot of engineers and very few of our own students, much to the chagrin of our own students, but they have to wait many, many years to figure that out. And that experience, and then it got replicated teaching in the MIT Portugal program, teaching engineering design students who were Portuguese or increasingly sort of more broadly European. And that really began to give me some insights into how it is that engineers think, what the problems that there are out there that they face, and what the real sort of intellectual differences between what they did and what I did. It was the first sort of really close contact for me with, you know, sort of having to actually work through, you know, sort of how do you set up a research project and how do you write a paper with somebody who had come out of this very different training. And then the other example I want to give is a course that a colleague and I are proposing to teach through this concourse, this freshman learning community, but we're going to invite upper-class students, those who had been freshmen in the program their first year but are still lurking around on campus, to come back and do this with us. And the course is called, going to be called, Making Books, the Renaissance and Today. And we've got three things we want to accomplish in this course. First of all, we want our students to study the history of the book in both Europe and East Asia. And so we're going to be reading the scholarly literature on book production and its impact, from Gutenberg, basically, to the present, so roughly 1450 to the digital revolution. The second thing we're going to do is actually go with the students multiple visits to examine in detail the collection of the MIT Rare Books Room, so that they can actually see both some, you know, really old and then some slightly less old books. And we have four categories of materials that we want them to examine in detail. Manuscripts that predate 1500. This is an important category for book people of printed books pre-1500 and a few manuscripts. And then a second category of books on early modern religion. So there's some pages from a Gutenberg Bible and a number of other sort of important early modern religious documents. The third section is going to be on early modern science. We're going to look at some very old editions of Galileo and Tycho Brahe and a few others. And then finally, MIT has a complete first edition of Diderot's Encyclopédie, and we're going to work with that material as well. So that's the second component, is the Rare Books Room. And then the third component, and we'll see how this really works, we want our students to build a functioning handset printing press. And we're still looking for a mechanical engineer who is going to be our supervisor for this. So if any of you know mechanical engineers at MIT that, you know, want to help, Larry, you're on my list of people to tap here. And, you know, we're going to see what happens. But in some ideal world, when the libraries get renovated, there'll be some space for this handset printing press, and it will live on, and students will be able to make their own books. So, stop there, because I'm totally out of time.